Right, let's pray, shall we? Oh, we'll just wait a minute. I'm operating from two computers today, and one of them's already decided he doesn't want to play, so it's going to be fun. Let's pray. Father God, I do want to also lift Jen and Tony and Hugh and Claire into your loving arms, that they may know peace and rest there, or that you will look after them as individuals and as a family. They will know your love. Father God, we're gathered here as your children, every one of us with the responsibility for looking to you and looking after each other. And we do ask that now in this time and also as we go forward, we'll be able to do exactly that. And ask these things in the name of your precious Son, Jesus. Amen. Usual. I could be wrong. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. We're all human beings. We make mistakes. Every human being who has ever lived, with the exception of Jesus, makes mistakes, has got things wrong at times. I appear to be working with three computers and two of them don't want to play. Okay, it's Palm Sunday. Just an outline of what we're going to do. This is going to be a bit different and it may even be memorable. What I want to do is just talk a little bit about Jesus and Palm Sunday and that kind of stuff, and then play you a recording. Jesus on Palm Sunday was going up to Jerusalem and he was going to die a violent death. I want to play you a recording, a 15-minute recording of a Christian man who was speaking and he was about to die a violent death. And his name's Martin Luther King. And you've probably, many of you, if not all of you, have heard bits of the mountaintop speech. The mountaintop speech is actually more than 40 minutes long. And there's a natural break about 15 minutes before the end. And I want to play the last 15 minutes of that speech to you. And it's packed full of really incredible stuff. But I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. Do you remember when we had that guy, we had a video of a guy doing a one-man reenactment of the whole of Matthew? I do remember we noticed that there was rather a lot of Jesus saying, don't tell anyone. He seemed to say that a lot. He said it a lot in Mark. He said it to his mother when his mother said, turn water into wine, do something. And Jesus said, my time has not yet come. And he was constantly telling people not to talk about it. When we get to Palm Sunday, the time for keeping quiet is over. It's time for action. It's time to make a noise. Jesus has done all the training of his disciples. He's done all the things that he needed to do. And it's time to fulfill his purpose on this earth, which is to die a violent death and then to be raised again. Jesus was going to Jerusalem willingly. He knew that he was putting him not just in danger. He knew what was going to happen. He'd been telling people what was going to happen. But he was willingly going into a very dangerous situation. And he was doing so unselfishly. We've been given the task of carrying on his work, and there's two broad elements to that. One is we're called to love God. One, which I really want to focus today, is we're called to love our neighbour, because Jesus' act of death was an act of love for us for all time, and it was an extraordinary act. Martin Luther King, also going to Memphis in April 1968, was putting himself in great danger. He knew he was. That's going to become clear as we go on. We don't put ourselves in danger, do we? Not like that. Should we be willing to put ourselves in that kind of danger? Is one of the questions I want us to allow to percolate this morning. Everybody knows this verse, don't you? This is a synopsis of what we're called to in Micah 8. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. You remember, it was last week, Luke stood up in front of us and talked about the possibility of the church getting involved in this thing of providing sanctuary for refugees, people who were supposed to be being sent back to Nauru and places, and that we actually offer sanctuary, we actually go out of our way to protect them, and that this would be civil disobedience, and there could be consequences. Yeah, I think this is the kind of thing we're talking about. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. Those two things of justice and mercy are a common theme right through Old Testament teaching. In fact, if you start with Abraham and you work right through the Old Testament and into the New Testament, you are consistently hearing... Excuse me. This must be good if my nose is running. It's always good when my nose is running. I put it down to four things that where there is this repeated... From God to the children of Israel, to us today, there's this repeated theme, four things. Give to the poor, befriend the alienated, stand up for the oppressed, seek justice for those who are not getting justice. He said the reason he chose Abraham was because he knew that Abraham was going to teach, it says in Genesis, was going to teach his children and his household to do mercy and righteousness, to do those things. And this is what we are called to: give to the poor, befriend the alienated, stand up for the oppressed, seek justice for those who are not getting justice. Those last two, you can't do quietly. The first one we're told to do quietly: give to the poor. You know, don't let other people know what you're doing. Befriend the alienated. Well, the alienated are certainly going to know that they're being befriended. But stand up for the oppressed and seek justice for those who are not getting justice. We have to make a noise. And I really don't think at the moment that the church, I don't just mean this church, I mean the church, is making enough noise. And I don't think it's an optional extra. I don't think it's something we can choose to do or not to do. I think it's something we are called to do. There's a lot of very glum faces here this morning. This is bad enough. What's coming next? Oh, it's going to be good, trust me. About 6 months ago, this must be brilliant. About 6 months ago, I did something which I do a couple of times a year, which is take myself out for lunch. And often that involves going to the Moon and Sixpence. I don't know if many of you here don't know about the Moon and Sixpence. It's a pub in Perth. And I have a pub lunch, and I have a couple of pints, usually of Old Speckled Hen, which is my favourite English bitter beer. And 6 months ago, roughly, I had one of these occasions. And I left the pub and walked into the Murray Street Mall, feeling mellow. I don't know why I went and sat down on a bench, one of those benches in the malls. You know, those benches are back to back. I sat down on this bench, and there was this big bunch of young people on the other side. Have I told this story before? No, okay, good. Big bunch of young people, all happy, hugging each other and saying hello, and they just sort of all got together. And one of them came, a young man, it turned out he was 17, and an American, he was Asian appearance, but it turned out he was 17, an American, came and he stood and looked down at me, and I sort of looked up at him, and he said, excuse me, sir, may I talk to you for a moment? And I thought, oh, well, I can immediately see where this is going. There was just something about him. And I sent an immediate arrow prayer through my 2 pints of bitter to God, saying, okay, your will be done, whatever you want. And this young man, I said, of course, yes, no problem. And he said, have you ever heard of YWAM? And I said, youth with a mission? Yes, I have. I'm not youth. I didn't say that. But we got talking, and we just talked about God. We just talked about Jesus for maybe 10 minutes. And it was good. It was very good. And he invited me to come to his church, the YWAM hub, which is in East Perth. I didn't know about this. And I went there. I've only been there for this one meeting, but I went there. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, mainly teens and 20s, some in their 30s, a few a bit older. And the energy and excitement and commitment in that building was just unbelievable. It was fantastic. The sermon was rubbish, but the energy is the best word I can find. There was fantastic, and I was feeling sad, Because I was thinking to myself, well, here we all are. YWAM has a particular mission. You know, these people were all working in the sort of Southeast Asia, Australian area, doing what they do. But I was thinking, here we are with this level of energy and excitement, and there are hundreds of churches across the Perth metro area. And in those, there are tens of thousands of people who claim to be followers of the teachings of Jesus. And what kind of an impact are we having on our small city? And I was sad, and it's bugged me ever since. I think maybe we are not making enough noise. I think one of the things that maybe we should be doing particularly are these last two, and that we should be making a noise as we do it. Overall, Jesus' teaching is that you don't make a noise. You do things quietly. But maybe we need to be, if you're standing up for the oppressed, if you're seeking justice for those who are not getting justice, you can't do that without making a noise. Right. Martin Luther King. Some time ago, I got this niggling thought in my head, and niggling thoughts I don't worry about too much, but this one just kept on niggling. And that was that it was about the mountaintop speech, which you've all heard of. You know this, I've been to the mountaintop, I've looked over, I've seen the promised land. And that I should use this somehow in church. So I just, you know, prayed about it every now and again. Couldn't really see any way I could work it into anything. And then along comes Palm Sunday and suddenly everything makes perfect sense. You know, Martin Luther King went to Memphis, probably knew that he was going to die. I think there's enough in his very last words in this speech that to indicate that he knew he was going to die. But you can make your own decision on that. Maybe not. Why did someone want to kill Martin Luther King? For exactly the same reason as they wanted to kill Jesus. He was dangerous. He was causing trouble. People who were in a comfortable situation were finding their life wasn't comfortable. And he actually went to Memphis to because there was a strike going on. The sanitation workers, garbage workers, sewage workers, the black ones were all on strike because they were getting appalling conditions. They just weren't getting the same money as the white guys. They didn't get the same conditions of service, and they were on strike. So he went to Memphis to lead a march for them to demonstrate solidarity with those workers. And the speech he gave was the night before he was shot. When he was making this speech, he actually had less than 24 hours to live. And it is just these 15 minutes that I'm going to play is extraordinary. I want to just do a few highlights from it because I want you to really, there's an awful lot in this. I just want you to pick up what he's saying. He talks a little bit at the beginning about this march and encouraging people to go on it. And in doing that, he gives a quick sermon on the Good Samaritan. And it's a, boy, can this guy talk? Not that I'm jealous, but honestly, can he speak? He talks about the Good Samaritan and does a mini sermon on the Good Samaritan. And his overall theme is that, you know, let me just do a quick aside here. He starts talking about the reasons why the priest and the Levite might have walked past. And we all know the normal ones about you're not allowed to go near a dead body if you're a Jew and that kind of thing. And he comes up with a couple which I hadn't thought of, one of which really appeals to my public servant heart. He says that maybe they were going to a meeting to institute a Jericho Road improvement safety movement. They were going to tackle this problem at the base. You know, they were going to make sure that this problem just disappeared for all people. So they didn't have time to actually help this guy who'd just been robbed. My public servant heart just resonated to that. And I could tell you stories, but I won't, of that when that kind of thing happened. But he also talks about the possibility that this man might actually have been faking it, that he might have been a member of the gang of robbers. Or that the robbers were still around and hoping that somebody else was going to come along. So in helping that man, they were putting themselves in danger. And I think that's a reasonable point. But he says, he's talking to the people to encourage them to come along to the march. And he says to them, you shouldn't be thinking, what will happen to me if I help this man? You should be thinking to yourself, what will happen to this man if I don't help him? That's his key point there. He then begins to talk about his own death, his own life and his death. Something I didn't know is that Martin Luther King was about 10 years before this, in the late 50s, someone had stabbed him. And he was signing books, and a woman, he calls her a demented woman. She was, no doubt about it, I suppose. While he was signing these books, came up and stabbed him in the chest. And the tip of the blade of the knife came right up to his aorta. They found out with the x-rays when they removed the blade in hospital. And the New York Times the next morning, he tells us the story. Telling the story, the New York Times said the next morning, if he had sneezed, he would have died. And he then goes on to talk about, as he recovered, he was given letters. There were letters and messages coming in from all over. And he talks about a message he got from a schoolgirl. And he says, I got a message from the president and the vice president and the governor of New York State. I can't remember what they said, but this schoolgirl, I can remember exactly what she said. And he then quotes this letter word for word. And I'm not going to tell you what she said, because he then goes on, it would spoil it. He then goes on to use what she said to talk about what he's done for the last 10 years. You know, and he's basically saying, if I had died at that moment, I wouldn't have been in this place. And if I had died, I wouldn't have led that march. If I had died, he specifically mentions the I Have a Dream speech. So he goes on like that. Then when he's done that, and he brings it up to the current time of being in Memphis, and he says, it doesn't matter now. It doesn't matter what happens now. And the shivers start going down your spine. He talks about all the preparations they had to make to get him into Memphis for the security of the plane that he was on. And he talks about the threats that had been made to his life if he was going to go to Memphis. And he says it doesn't matter. And then he makes the mountaintop speech. There's something about the mountaintop speech I just think I ought to need to point out. We use mountaintop experience in a particular way, which means a great experience. You know, you really felt you were with God, or you went to a brilliant conference or something like that. He's specifically talking about Moses's mountaintop experience. So Moses has been leading the children of Israel through the desert for 40 years, and they've got right up to the River Jordan, and they're about to cross over into the Promised Land. And God says to Moses, you're not going to see it, has already said to him, you're not going to see it, and you're not going to enter it, sorry. But he takes him up onto a mountaintop, and he shows him the Promised Land. He sees all of Canaan stretched out before him. Must have long sight, by the way it's described in the Bible. But he sees the Promised Land, but he's not allowed to enter it. He dies just then. So that is the reference, the very famous words that Martin Luther King gives at that moment. Something that Martin Luther King says towards the beginning of this section, which really rang in my head: let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. I just thought this was wonderful. An important thing about Martin Luther King is he did all that over a period of about 10 to 12 years. He did all those amazing things. He made a massive impact on the American nation. And there are so many black people and people of a number of races, and I think people of all races, who could be thankful for what he did. He died at the age of 39 as a 65-year-old. I mean, I just find that staggering. He was 39 when he died, and he'd done all that. Right, I'm going to see if I can get this computer to say interesting things to each other for a second.
Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Be concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, But either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus, and he wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. And he talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. And finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy, but he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonials was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right, that's right.
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. And you know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." The next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the X-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around into a wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. Yes. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze." And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960, when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream, and taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yeah, what can you say? I'm going to change my style of preaching. And hopefully it's going to sound like that from now on. So, let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. What's that going to mean for us comfortable millionaires living here in Western Australia? What might it look like? What might we be called to do? Where's the mic? There it is. Can you do your usual mobile microphone stand bit? Thanks, Kelly. Tyson?
I have to say that for me, when I was younger and got involved in a muck and was working with Stephen McKinnon and doing visits on, you know, different agencies of people working with marginalised people in Perth, there was a sense of being able to go and do the dangerous stuff. And as I've had kids and a family, my willingness to have strangers in the house and to offer hospitality and things like that has had limits on it that I didn't maybe expect when I was younger. And I also anticipate when my kids are old enough that they don't need me in that same way, that I would be probably more willing to take risks than I am at the moment. So there's, I feel like I have safety built in somehow as part of my thinking around dangerous stuff.
It strikes me that the motivating reason for doing what we do is really important. And when I've read about Mother Teresa, she spoke about how she's written in her journals how often she was disheartened, discouraged, fearful, angry at God, etc., etc. And that the motivation for her was to get up very early every morning and pray for 2 hours. And that was the motivator, not her sense of something she should do. Yeah.
Tyson's got me thinking about that safety and getting into the world and doing stuff, and I feel like I was late to the party. We were just about having kids by the time I was starting to think about doing dangerous things, to use the term. But I didn't know how, and I didn't really have people around me that, I don't know, that I felt I could talk to about it, or maybe they were there and I didn't know. But I think there's a knowledge gap or an experience gap or something that I'm looking to fill, but yeah, having people around me is important.
I was just going to add it strikes me that if you go back to your 4 points there, Peter, those points around justice and standing up for the oppressed, for me, is about being involved as an active citizen in our community. And when we retreat and cut ourselves off from the rest of the community, then it's easy to ignore all of that stuff. I learnt in a democracy unit once with Ian Barnes. Some of you may know Ian. He said that the ancient Greeks had two terms. One was citizen, for people who participated in society, and the other word was idiot, was the people who, we get the word idiosyncrasy, you know, it's somebody who withdraws from society. And I like that we've associated the word idiot with someone who's stupid, because I think that to me is the association, that when you withdraw and exclude yourself from society and don't participate and don't add to the value of it, then I think you're an idiot, to be honest.
Paul? There is a time to stand up and be noisy in the kind of way that you're talking about, Peter, but I think there is also a time when, as part of your family, you need to protect your family, and it is entirely appropriate that you focus on keeping your family safe. But I know just from watching and observing you, there are a million different ways that you stand up for the oppressed already in lots of different ways through the people that you have in your home. So that is just as noisy and just as dangerous an unselfishness as the kind that Peter's talking about. But I think there is a message to us old farts who no longer have that immediate pressing need for safety. And I find myself increasingly needing to transform my anger into and self-righteous indignation into something that's more productive, and going to things like Palm Sunday, taking part in street marches, in anything that provides a public voice for the marginalised, for the asylum seekers, is really important. So I think this is very much a message to those of us who are older, who are thinking we could sink into our golf shoes, and that this is the time to stand up. So thank you for what you said.
Well, what groups have we got in our community who need to be stood up for? We're going to be focusing a bit on refugees at Easter camp, but I have a heart for refugees. I spent it on... Bevan?
I just feel that the email system we employ at home is such that I get a lot of the hate email that comes through and how I respond to that.
Yes.
Because a lot of them are friends, people I know, and they all... espouse, you know, you can see what these Muslims are doing, you see what is happening now. And how I respond is sort of standing up for the oppressed. It's only a small way, I agree.
Yeah. No, but it's
because
important.
You get the ire of your friends then, you know, because you say, no, that's not truth.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really, really important. I mean, people may... you know, discredit Facebook. The world lives on Facebook. And even among Christians, you start reading stuff on Facebook and you think, that is completely out of order. And I think if that's where you are and that's your community, then yes, you stand up against it. And you share the good stuff and argue against the bad stuff. I think that's what you do. I think it's a very important way because you don't know who's going to share the stuff you say. You know, it can... yeah, well, use the phrase "go viral," but you know, it's keeping the pressure on. It's saying, my mission, God-given mission, is to encourage Christians to follow the teachings of Jesus. I know that. That's what I do here. It's what I do online. I do it all over the place. But it's really important that if you see a Christian saying something which is quite clearly against the teachings of Jesus, that you let them know. Sorry, Jen.
That's okay. For the last couple of years, I've been really looking at places in Perth, and the thing about using public transport is you get to see things that perhaps if you're stuck in your car or you're on a bike path, you don't tend to see. And I think that everybody deserves to have a safe place to sleep at night. And the concern for me about the homeless is that they don't. And I see these areas in Perth that... with a minimal expenditure on the part of the Perth City Council or a charity group or somebody, it would be easy to erect some sort of multiple temporary dwelling that would be overseen. And I've looked at that, and obviously our children are grown up, and I feel like I'm on the cusp of being able to start lobbying on behalf of those people to try and open the eyes of the bureaucracy to see that there are ways that homeless people can be made safe.
No.
One of the feelings I get from stuff like this is I become overwhelmed by the enormity of it all.
Yes.
But I've had the experience in the last 2 weeks. I've started to volunteer with the Orange Sky Laundry, the two guys that won the Young Australian of the Year have opened up in Perth. I go once a fortnight for 3 hours. You don't have to start big. You just have to start. And also, what might be relevant for me, somebody else is going to go, no thanks.
Yep.
And if it's building something, you know, huge, or I don't know, it might only be a letter to someone.
Yep.
Don't be overwhelmed by the size of this.
Yep. No. What do they do?
They park the van outside Rua, and they have other places all around Perth. The van has 2 commercial washers and 2 commercial dryers and a source of water and a source of power, and they do the washing of anybody who needs it. And it's fantastic. It's really interesting. It's very challenging, but it's so basic. And it's fun.
Yeah, can I just say 2 things on that? Absolutely and absolutely. There is far too much, and particularly in a world where we know an awful lot about what's going on and how much misery there is on the entire globe. The question has to be, what does God want me to do? What skills has he given me? What abilities has he given me? And you focus on that thing. You don't try. You'd be completely overwhelmed if you tried to do everything else. And I've totally forgotten what the second point was.
Just in answer to that question about groups, another group that I'm particularly concerned about is people in prison. There's a huge amount of injustice in our justice system. There's a huge amount of scapegoating that goes on in prisons. And one of the big problems is that they are locked away and inaccessible. So it's really difficult to find out anything about what's going on and have any impact. I've been fortunate through my work. I've had a couple of toes in. So it frustrates me that I see a big need and I'm not too sure how to penetrate it.
I remember what the second point was. It was what you said, that it doesn't have to be a big thing. No, it can be a tiny thing. And I've got a particular concern for Aboriginal Australia, for our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. And I did work in that area for a while and then came out of it. I'm very sad about that, but that was the way it was. But one thing I know I can do is when I'm walking through the centre of Perth and I see an Aboriginal man walking towards me, look him in the eye, and if he actually catches eye, just nod and say, all right. That actually makes a difference, because most white people just don't do that. So it can be as simple as that.
It strikes me in the work that I do, the most important person who works for Toll is the person that I'm talking to at that time. I'm actually going to Wurraloo tomorrow to talk to someone in prison. But my sense is that it's the person in the car park alongside you, it's the person at the shopping centre. We don't have to do a taxonomical exercise to figure out if they deserve our mercy. Yeah, anyway.